Right. And now, not only was I still angry and frustrated, now I felt guilty as well.
We have to get him. Matthew, we're hamstrung here until we do, and sooner or later someone high up is going to decide we're not worth the effort and expense, and that'll be the end of us.
Well, let's hope it never comes to that, he sighed. I will take this idea of yours to my boss and talk her into it. And you never know, it might work.
It will work, I said stoutly. Just make sure you get him this time.
We'll give it our best shot, he said. You know we will. Now I must go. I'll talk to you soon, I promise. I nodded. Okay. Take care.
You too.
He disappeared in the direction of his pod. I turned away, meaning to take a stroll around the water garden and calm down a little. Fat chance, because as if I didn't have enough to think about already, yet another disaster was, even at this moment, hurtling towards St. Mary's. As I rounded the first corner, there was Dottle, draped over a bench like a pre-Raphaelite painting, and sobbing as if her heart would break. Wrapped up as I was in my own problems, even I could see something was wrong here. I stood helplessly.
Lisa, whatever is the matter?
There was a lot of snorting and sniffing and nose-wiping. Like me, she's not a pretty crier, but the gist of it was that the idiot Halcombe was coming back. My heart sank. This was the last thing we needed.
Oh, shit. When?
She was vague as to the details, and there was even more snorting and sniffing and nose-wiping. I plonked myself alongside her. This was not good news. We had Dottle well-trained. Yes, she sat in on our briefings, but other than that, she didn't trouble us, and we didn't trouble her. The idiot Halcombe was another kettle of fish entirely. On the other hand, maybe he'd learned his lesson. Namely, don't mess with St. Mary's, or you'll spend a year being treated for the leprosy you don't have. Perhaps, once he was back, we could persuade him he'd picked up some kind of flesh-eating bacteria from someone. Markham seemed a safe bet. And pack him off for another 6 months of painful injections. I said some of this to her, and she gave a snot-filled snort, which I chose to believe was a laugh, blew her nose and said,
I'm sure you're right, and now that he's coming back to St. Mary's, I'm worried he's going to want his job back again.
The idiot Halcombe, or Mr. Halcombe, as he inexplicably insisted on being called, was the result of our naughtiness a year or so ago, when Thirsk had finally made good their threat and installed a permanent presence here to keep an eye on us. Miss Dottle had been his slightly oppressed assistant. He'd muscled his way onto the Caernarfon assignment, and it had all gone horribly wrong. Nothing too unusual there, but the bastard had pushed off and left them in trouble. He'd ordered a withdrawal and returned to the safety of St. Mary's, leaving half the team behind, including his own Miss Dottle, and I'd had to go and get them. There had been a street riot and enormous quantities of pollocks. Yes, I know the plural of pollock is pollock, but the jokes are better if you say pollocks. Especially in the history department, where sophisticated humour and an elegant play on words don't ever happen. Anyway, we're St. Mary's, and he'd contravened one of our most important rules. We never leave our people behind. So we'd had to get rid of him as soon as possible. And given that there was a 10 trillion to 1 chance that he'd managed to contract leprosy, we sent him off to the leprosy clinic with instructions for them not to bother sending him back. Alas. And the timing could not have been more unfortunate. We certainly didn't want the idiot muscling in on the Persepolis jump. This was an unfortunate coincidence that would have to be dealt with. I stared at my feet, lost in thought.
He's bound to want his job back, he said.
Not quite wringing out her hanky, but close.
And I've worked so hard, and I'm good at it, and...
She stopped suddenly. And she had the world's hugest crush on Peterson, who really didn't help himself by smiling kindly at her whenever she passed. I wasn't too sure of their relationship status, and she did seem content to worship him from afar, something the rest of St. Mary's would do well to emulate, he always said. But yes, she was right. Halcombe would want his job back, and she would almost certainly return to the thankless task of many women, that of being assistant to an idiot. I really didn't know what to say to her. Perhaps, given her hopeless passion for Peterson, it would be better for her to move on. Forget him and build a life somewhere else. I don't know.
My own life is frequently so tangled that I never really feel I'm a suitable person to advise others. And it has often been pointed out to me I'm not really a role model for distressed young women, or distressed young men, or anyone, actually. I could see she was in need of a little gentle sympathy and support, however, so I clapped her on the shoulder, told her to buck up, buttercup, and took her in for some tea.
Chapter 7. He arrived 2 days later, earlier than Dottle had thought he would, much earlier than Dr. Bairstow had bargained for, and worst of all, before we'd got Persepolis out of the way. I watched him pull into the car park and unload his suitcases. He would need to be got rid of, by lawful means preferably, but if that didn't work. Somewhere in the depths of St. Mary's, a handbell pealed and a voice intoned, "Unclean! Unclean!" He made his presence felt almost immediately by falling foul of Psycho Sykes. Hitting the ground running, and probably wanting to avoid a repeat of his one and only catastrophic assignment, he thought he'd instigate a series of risk assessments and method statements. It did not go well. We were all in the hall working away. There were files and whiteboards everywhere. There were odd bits of paper pinned to the walls. A couple of data stacks twirled in digital limbo. We had Mrs. Enderby with us, trying to sort out what we were to wear in Persepolis. Bashford was trying, unsuccessfully, to measure his own inside leg, and Sykes was watching him without pity.
52 inches,
he announced, so God knows where he'd had his tape measure. Mrs. Enderby ignored him, stared appraisingly at me for a moment, and then said, "I understand you're expecting to be even more than usually active on this assignment, so I've cheated a little, Max. We've run you up a chiton in the Doric style. More room for movement." I nodded. Not a bad idea. The Doric tunic was much more modest and less drapey, and importantly, it was held together considerably more securely than by just a pin at one shoulder, which was all very well if your day consisted of lounging around eating grapes, but was less useful if you were dodging drunken soldiers, burning buildings, and the like. Legend says that a long time ago in ancient Greece, the messenger bringing the sad news of their husbands' deaths in some battle or other had been set upon by the grieving widows, who had stabbed him to death with their own shoulder pins. Being a messenger in ancient times was a hazardous occupation, presumably giving rise to the saying, "Don't shoot the messenger." Anyway, the authorities, casting a wary eye on pin-wielding widows, had henceforth forbidden women to fasten their chitons with pins, so the Doric chiton was an altogether sturdier garment, which was good for me. My chiton was almost a straight tunic, and very easy to move around in. That settled, I turned back to the others, who were discussing whether to dress as contemporaries or go in full firefighting gear. Clerk was arguing that those who would be concentrating on Alexander could dress in contemporary costumes, while only those actually attempting to get into the treasury would need firesuits. We'd reached the point where everyone was trying to work out the difference between flammable and inflammable, and the debate was vigorous because no one knew the answer, when the idiot Halcombe turned up with his latest recipe for catastrophe. I was talking to Miss Dottle when she peered over my shoulder and said quietly, "Max, he's coming." I turned, and the idiot Halcombe was coming down the stairs, scratch pad in hand.
"May I have your attention, please?"
Somewhere at the very back of the hall, the handbell rang again, and an anonymous voice called, "Unclean! Unclean!" Wisely, Halcombe ignored it.
"I've been carrying out a series of risk assessments which, while they will radically alter the way we operate, will, I think you will agree, result in a much higher success rate than this establishment has hitherto experienced."
"You mean we stick our noses out the door and then run for home in case it starts to rain?"
suggested Clerk, and someone laughed. It had been Clerk's assignment the idiot Halcombe had buggered up, and he obviously hadn't either forgotten or forgiven.
"Not precisely," countered Halcombe. "But certainly more time will be spent assessing the situation in advance, rather than just bursting out of the pod and immediately finding ourselves in difficulties."
"We?"
said Clerk, obviously determined not to let it go.
"Ourselves? You're surely not proposing to include yourself in our merry little jaunts?"
Halcombe ignored him and soldiered on.
"Perhaps the most important of our new routines will be the exclusion of women on certain assignments."
The temperature dropped, like a stone. Everything stopped. Even the walls leaned in to listen. No one said a word. The idiot didn't even notice. I started to work my way down the hall because I might have to save a life in a minute.
"I'm sorry," said Sykes sweetly. "My tiny female brain was unable to process your last statement."
Reaching the front, I nudged her into silence.
"Are you saying the type of assignment will determine the gender of those carrying it out?"
"Exactly," he beamed. I persevered. It wasn't yet too late for him.
"Are you absolutely certain this is a course you want to pursue?"
"I am. I think you will agree that there are some areas where the presence of women is inappropriate. Battlefields, for instance. Well, no one can deny the presence of a female at, say, Bannockburn would not only be distracting and dangerous, but historically inaccurate as well. My proposal is that female historians confine themselves to social and domestic issues, which would free up male historians to concentrate on the more important aspects of history."
"You mean history?" said Sykes.
"Idiot can't even get that right," muttered Clerk.
"What is he talking about?"
whispered Prentice to me.
"I'm not sure," I said, "but I think he's saying it's a man's world."
She looked around at Mrs. Mack, Mrs. Enderby, Miss Lee, Miss Lingos, Mrs. Partridge, Miss Sykes, and Miss North, none of whom should be crossed even for a brief second.
"When did that happen?"
"Apparently about 30 seconds ago."
"Oh, wow," said Sykes in excitement. "Does this mean I'm a plucky little woman struggling to make her way in a man's world? I've always wanted to be a plucky little woman struggling to make her way in a man's world. Please, please."
"Stop whining," I said. "Plucky little women never whine." Miss North made a sound indicating that actually, far from struggling in a man's world, men frequently struggled in hers. "No, he's made a very good point," said Bashford provocatively. "Women are just vessels, you know."
"That's very true," said Sykes, smiling angelically at him. "I myself am a 17,000-ton dreadnought-class battleship with enough firepower to destroy a medium-sized city."
Well, no one was going to argue with that. Halcombe stood his ground and prepared to argue his point.
"I'm simply saying," he said.
"I wouldn't," said Peterson, gently taking his arm. "I really wouldn't."
"What are you doing?"
"Taking you to Dr. Stone to discuss your apparent death wish." He pulled his arm away angrily and stamped back up the stairs. We watched him make his way around the gallery.
"Like a disdainful flamingo with a stick up its arse,"
said Markham, quoting someone whose identity escapes me for the moment. Halcombe's office door slammed.
"He's gotta go,"
said Markham to me, and I would have agreed, except that as I opened my mouth, a terrible scream echoed around the building. I suppose, in normal places of employment, a terrible scream echoing around the building would produce some sort of reaction. At the very least, heads would lift. Someone might possibly say, "Did you hear that?" And someone else might say, "I think so." And there would be vague looking around, as if the reason for the terrible scream would helpfully waft down the staircase and make itself known. This being St. Mary's, none of that happened. Terrible screams are 10 a penny here, and could range from Markham shutting his finger in a door, you'd think he'd lost his entire arm, to Professor Rapson drinking from a beaker subsequently discovered to be clearly marked with a skull and crossbones and bearing the legend, "Do not drink, deadly poison." Just to be clear, on that occasion the scream emanated from his panicking staff, not the professor himself, who throughout the entire stomach-pumping process maintained his traditional air of slight bewilderment at all the fuss. Anyway, back to the current crisis, the terrible scream and its dying echoes. St. Mary's continued with its normal working day because, quite honestly, if we stopped working for every terrible scream and its dying echoes, we'd never get any work done at all. Every organisation has its weak link, however. A door opened and the idiot Halcombe appeared again, this time inquiring who was making that ridiculous noise. Every person in sight immediately became completely immersed in what they were doing. I sighed. If only they could display the same level of dedicated focus during a normal working day. Given that all I could see was the back of everyone else's heads, any response was obviously up to me. No idea, I said, but it seems to have stopped now, and tried to slide past him to return to the safety of my own office. Easier said than done. Our housekeeper, the majestic Mrs. Midgley, was descending the stairs, as unstoppable as a glacier on its way to the sea to mate with the icebergs. Actually, I don't know what put that picture in my head, but I really wished it hadn't. We don't see a lot of her. She prefers, she says, to carry out her duties behind the scenes and not in any way associate herself with the madness for which St. Mary's is apparently legendary. I remember crossing my fingers as she approached and hoping I was not her ultimate destination. I didn't see how she could possibly want me. Yes, Leon had put his foot through a sheet a couple of weeks ago, but he was a firm favourite of hers, and she'd let him off with no more than a finger wagging as he stood before her, head bowed in contrition. What she could possibly want with me was a mystery. She shouldered aside the idiot Halcombe as if he didn't exist. I should be that lucky. And deposited a small pile of towels on the table in front of me, and demanded to know, in a voice which rang from one end of the hall to the other, what was the meaning of this. I stared, baffled, first at the small pile of six clean white hand towels, and then pathetically around the hall, seeking assistance from someone. Anyone. Markham folded his arms and grinned at me. Peterson was apparently engrossed in a file with Miss Dottle and too busy to notice what was going on, and there was no sign of Leon anywhere. You have to ask yourself, what is the point of being married if your husband is too busy repairing a pod to rescue his wife from an enraged towel-bearing housekeeper? I'm sorry, Mrs. Midgley, I don't understand. Is there a problem with the towels? Her not unsubstantial bosom heaved with passion.
Not the towels, no.
Well, what then? She peeled back the top four layers to reveal what looked like a puddle of furry raspberry jam, with legs. St. Mary's crowded round.
Oh, yuck! What is it?
Miss Dottle pushed her way through the crowd.
Oh, no! It's Hammy!
Hammy?
Hamlet!
I stared accusingly across at Markham, who had once appeared in a 17th-century production of Hamlet. He'd understudied Shakespeare after the great man had set fire to himself. On the face of it, however, Markham seemed as baffled as I was. I said cautiously, "Hamlet?"
"My hamster!"
We're not allowed pets, except for Mrs. Mack's beloved Vortigern, the kitchen cat, of course, and Angus the chicken, and Markham from security. And now it would appear Miss Dottle had a hamster. Had a hamster.
But what,
demanded Mrs. Midgley, not one to lose sight of her target, was a hamster doing in my airing cupboard in the first place? Dottle sniffed.
Well, I woke up one morning and he was stretched out in the bottom of his little cage and I thought he was dead.
She sniffed again.
And I was taking him out to the garden to bury him when I met Professor Rapson.
She paused to rifle her pockets for a handkerchief. I sighed and turned to Miss Lingos. Today's hair was metallic bronze. She looked like a statue of the goddess Athena. My compliments to Professor Rapson. Could he spare me a moment, please?
Righty-ho!
She was gone in a flash, appearing a moment later with the professor, who was absent-mindedly patting his pockets for his glasses.
On your head, Professor, said Miss Lingos kindly.
Really?
Oh, so they are. Thank you, my dear.
He hooked them over his ears and smiled at me.
Good afternoon, Max. What can I do for you?
Good afternoon, Professor. I wonder if you could shed any light on this. I flipped back the towels as I spoke.
Oh, my goodness, is that Hammy?
I don't know how many dead hamsters he thought there would be in our airing cupboard. Miss Dottle nodded wetly.
Why is he so flat?
Miss Dottle burst into tears, and so I turned to the Professor for enlightenment.
Well, I met Miss Dottle and she was very upset because she thought her hamster was dead, as it happens. I had a hamster as a small boy and the same thing happened to me.
They thought you were dead, said Markham, deliberately muddying the issue.
No, he said seriously. I thought my hamster had died, but she hadn't, she was just sleeping.
I stared at him. Yes, all right, you see it written on tombstones all the time. Not dead. Just sleeping. But I had no idea that saying originated with hamsters. Tombstone images crashed into my mind. I was sure the day was fast approaching when I was going to need psychiatric help.
"You see," he said, peering at me over his spectacles, "hamsters hibernate, Max. If the temperature drops off, then so do they. Apparently, many a hamster has been prematurely interred, as I told Miss Dottle, and obviously we didn't want that, did we? So I suggested she pop him somewhere warm and see if he woke up. So we put him in the airing cupboard."
Mrs. Midgley's bosom reared up again, to the peril of all. "And when exactly did this happen?"
"Last week."
A lesser woman would have staggered.
"I've had a dead hamster in my fresh linen for a week."
Dottle gulped and nodded. Trying to keep my voice steady, I said, "Exactly how long should Hammy's period of recovery have taken, Professor?"
"Oh, my dear Miss Dottle, I'm so sorry. I'm afraid there's been a little bit of a misunderstanding. 30 to 45 minutes would probably have been sufficient."
Our heat-seeking housekeeper was homing in again.
"You left a dead hamster in my fresh linen for a week?"
Atherton, who's a nice boy, offered her a glass of water.
"No,"
said Dottle, still distressed.
"I went to get him out an hour later, but he wasn't there. I thought either he'd woken up or run away or..."
She gulped.
"He'd died and been taken away."
I was trying not to laugh. I could just see Dottle peeking into the airing cupboard and assuming Hammy had been wafted up to hamster heaven. In reality, of course, someone had just unknowingly dumped a load of towels on top of him, and if he hadn't been dead before, sensitive readers might want to go with that assumption, he had certainly been dead afterwards. Probably best not to mention that, and certainly not to Miss Dottle, who was weeping like the Trevi Fountain. The solution was to take her away for a cup of tea, grovel to Mrs. Midgley, remove poor Hammy from his white, fluffy sepulchre, and carry on with our working day. So, obviously, this was the point at which Malcolm Halcombe decided to showcase his management skills. Glaring around, he ordered everyone back to work, including Mrs. Midgley. I tell you, this bloke was living permanently in the shadow of death. Leprosy would have been nothing to this. And to demonstrate his mastery of the situation, demanded Miss Dottle fetch him the file on something or other. She blew her long pink nose. I noticed suddenly she'd gone back to the droopy cardigans again, and went to scuttle off, only to be prevented by Peterson, the world's kindest man, who said he was awfully sorry, but Miss Dottle was scheduled for a meeting with him, which should in fact have started some 10 minutes ago, and was she ready? She nodded, and he took her away for a damp half-hour of tea and tears. Mrs. Midgley shot the idiot Halcombe a look, which sadly failed to incinerate him on the spot, and departed with her towels. The rest of us ignored him, and after a minute he drifted off whence he came. I said to Markham, "You're right. He's got to go." Obviously we tried to carry on as normal. When I say normal, you know what I mean. But the bloke was everywhere. You couldn't have a private conversation without him turning up at your elbow, demanding to know what was the subject under discussion. We took to meeting in my office. Rosie Lee would lock the door and pull down the blind, and we would hold the meeting in whispers. We tried everything to get rid of him. We ignored him. We were downright rude to him. Nothing seemed to have any effect. 2 days later, there was an all-staff briefing from Dr. Bairstow. As if I didn't have enough to do preparing for Persepolis, liaising with Thirsk over the crown, not worrying about Leon or Matthew, and dodging the idiot Halcombe. I kid you not, some days I barely sat down. I was in the front row with Peterson on one side and Markham on the other, all of us wearing expressions of rapt enthusiasm. Professor Rapson and Dr. Dowson were on the end. Our days of sitting at the back and playing battleships were long gone. Dr. Bairstow opened the briefing.
"I would like, officially, to welcome Mr. Halcombe, who returned to this unit a few days ago after a long absence."
He paused. Traditionally, there should have been a round of polite applause. After a moment, when it became clear that on this occasion tradition was being ignored, he continued.
"In a not unrelated item, I should make it clear that from this moment onwards, the practice of walking in front of Mr. Halcombe, ringing a handbell and shouting, 'Unclean, unclean,' is to cease forthwith. Have I made myself clear?"
St. Mary's swallowed its disappointment and nodded, I sat back in my chair and watched the dust dancing in the sunlight shafting through the big glass lantern above Dr. Bairstow's head. I usually go on to describe how it picked out the highlights in his hair, but those days were gone as well, along with most of his hair, although the little bit around the back was hanging on for grim death. Peterson nudged me, and I lurched back to the here and now.
"And so," Dr. Bairstow was saying, "in the light of this recent legislation, it is necessary for you all to present proof of life. In other words, for bureaucratic purposes, at least, you need to prove you are not dead."
Someone somewhere snorted and tried to turn it into a cough.
"Normally," he continued, "I would simply request you to present yourselves before me in my office, where I could use my own skill and judgment to decide your existential status. But Mrs. Partridge informs me that, as with everything government-related, things are not that simple. You will therefore be required to complete the forms she will distribute at the end of this session and return them to her by 10 a.m. tomorrow."
I nodded. "I could do that.
Easy peasy."
He raised his voice slightly.
"Together with some form of photographic evidence, I shall then compare photographed document, keep my inevitable reflections to myself, sign and stamp where appropriate, and forward to the relevant government department, where it will be lost, misfiled, challenged, queried, denied, eaten by their computer, lost again, and finally returned to me in 3 or 4 years, by which time no doubt most of you will have achieved your apparent ambition to end your lives in a flamboyant and spectacular manner, and I shall have to begin again."
I don't know why he was looking at me, but I beamed anyway, just to reassure him that none of the above was anything to do with me, and for some reason, he didn't look reassured at all. Markham raised his hand.
"Photographic evidence, sir?"
"Yes, anything will do. Driving license."
Bollocks. By popular demand, I'd cut mine up. There had been a bit of a celebration afterwards.
"Passport?"
Bollocks. I didn't have one of those either.
"What about our St. Mary's ID cards?"
I said hopefully.
"No, only an official government document is eligible."
"But I work for the government."
"Yes, but they don't know that."
All around me I could hear the buzz of conversation with much rifling of wallets. I raised my hand again.
"Would a marriage certificate do, sir?"
He sighed.
"Is there a photograph attached?"
"I could enclose one of me and Leon cutting the cake."
He stared at me coldly.
"No."
"Then I might have a problem, sir."
Several other people said, "Me too." "We're St. Mary's. Our lives are full of files and forms and paperwork of some kind or another. We see no reason to burden ourselves with even more of it in our private lives." The buzzing rose to a clamour. Dr. Bairstow held up his hand.
"Mrs. Partridge has informed me that those of you unable to comply can get around this obstacle by presenting any photographic image no more than 6 months old."
I was surprised the sighs of relief didn't bowl him over, but, as usual, he'd left the kicker right to the end.
"These images must be presented to Mr. Halcombe, who will, if he feels like it, countersign and date them, thus ensuring their validity."
Another of the boss's brilliant moves. Presenting the correct paperwork for anything is always a challenge for St. Mary's, and when you add photographs as well, and to a stickler like Halcombe, the ensuing struggles would keep both him and us occupied for weeks. I caught Dr. Bairstow's eye and grinned. He ignored me.
"And if he doesn't feel like it?"
inquired Markham, cautiously, obviously seeing difficulties ahead. Many of the handbell ringers had come from his section.
"Then I suppose you will have to reconcile yourselves to eking out the remainder of your lives in a state of official non-existence. As far as the government is concerned, you will be dead. I'm sure that many of you would be happier if things were the other way around, but as we so frequently discover, this is not a perfect world."
"Well, that's not so bad," said Cox. "I could quite happily live a life of official non-existence." Dr. Bairstow smiled thinly.
"I should perhaps advise you now that a state of official non-existence will lead to a corresponding state of official non-existence regarding your salary. While as director of this unit I welcome and applaud the thought of so drastically reducing the wages bill, as a caring human being..."
He paused, but no one seemed willing to challenge him on that point. "I advise you to approach Mr. Halcombe, offer him whatever inducements you feel appropriate, and get it done, Mr. Cox." He scowled. "Yes, sir." Not that the idiot Halcombe looked any happier at the thought of every member of St. Mary's trudging through his door armed with incorrectly completed paperwork, inappropriate photographs, and a ton of attitude. "Moving on, Professor Rapson informs me that what I believe has become known as the Great Battering Ram Experiment will take place this afternoon after lunch. All personnel wishing to participate are to assemble behind the stables at 1500 hours. I have no doubt that most of you will wish to do so, thus rendering much of what I have said concerning proof of life irrelevant. More prudent members of staff were advised to remain inside, don protective clothing, and stay well away from the windows. Are there any questions?" We were already getting our stuff together prior to going back to work. There were never any questions. And then a voice said, "Actually, there is just one thing." The idiot Halcombe was on his feet. "While we're on the subject of paperwork, I wonder if I might have a word."
"Of course,"
said Dr. Bairstow pleasantly, limped down the stairs and seated himself alongside Peterson. Halcombe took his place on the half-landing, fussing with various sheets of paper. Finding what he needed, he held up a blue flimsy.
"What is this?"
We peered. My heart sank. It was blue, so it had originated from the history department. The large blob of chicken shit in the top right-hand corner designated it as one of Mr. Bashford's efforts. "Well," I said, standing up and taking it off him, "it looks to me like Mr. Bashford's report on the 1536 assignment. Bashford, you don't spell caparison like that. Learn to use the spell check."
"Not that. This."
I peered artistically, then took out my specs, carefully wiped off the worst of the greasy fingerprints, and peered again. He was pointing at the blob of chicken shit. Obviously, Angus had assisted Bashford with his report. "I've no idea. Did you sick up something while you were reading it? Because that has happened."
"It's chicken excrement," he said, outraged.
"No," I said, astonished.
"Is it?
How on earth did that happen? Were you reading it in a chicken coop? Or in the farm down the road?" said Sykes.
"Or that dreadful battery place on the other side of Rushford?"
inquired Mrs. Mack.
"You shouldn't have anything to do with them. We only have free range here."
A dozen other voices piped up, all apparently eager to solve the mystery of the unexplained chicken shit. The briefing began to deteriorate somewhat. I think we might have got away with it, except that, with the lack of self-preservation for which all of St. Mary's is so renowned, Angus chose this moment to wander down the stairs, presumably on her way from Bashford's wardrobe to the stables, where she would enjoy luncheon. Well, I say wonder, but she hasn't quite got the hang of stairs. The first two or three were fine, as she jumped inelegantly from step to step, but, as usual, gravity was not her friend, and she tumbled the last half-dozen steps, feathery arse over plumy tip, to land with a faint squawk at the bottom. No one moved. I cast an anxious glance at Dr. Bairstow, but he appeared to be immersed in the file Peterson had opened, and, unfortunately, neither seemed aware of circumstances around them. Halcombe pointed a finger.
"What is that?"
"What's what?" inquired Markham, staking his claim to be the first in the ensuing Halcombe mocking programme. "Are we still talking about your pile of poo?"
"That?"
He pointed at Angus, who had picked herself up, smoothed her ruffled feathers, crooned her love to Bashford, and was now sashaying down the hall en route to the kitchen, where she could bum a tasty treat from someone, give Vortigern a serious beaking, and make her way to the stables for a substantial repast.
"What?"
said Markham, cleverly peering at the spot where Angus had last been.
That chicken!"
St. Mary's began to look up, down, around, in, out, left, right, and inventing several new directions that had yet to be named. People began to look under chairs, pat their pockets.
"Have you got the invisible chicken?"
"No, I thought you had the invisible chicken."
"I had the invisible chicken yesterday. It's your turn today."
People began to wander vaguely around, calling, "Here, chicken! Here,
Jiggy, jiggy.
The briefing appeared to be descending into noisy chaos. Dr. Bairstow closed his file with a snap and stood up.
Enough!
The noise subsided immediately. Unwisely, Halcombe opened his mouth to have another go. Dr. Bairstow began to climb the stairs, pausing long enough to pat his arm gently.
I'd leave it there if I were you, there's a good chap.
And continued on his way. With a face of thunder, the idiot Halcombe returned to his office. Peterson turned to me.
He's got to go.
Chapter 8. I had a lovely lunch with Leon. We sat by the windows at one of the quiet tables, and just for once no one disturbed us. We chatted about Matthew and his impending visit, things we could do together and so on. I inquired whether he would be participating in the professor's little soiree that afternoon, and he laughed.
I'm infirm, not insane. I shall visit Ian this afternoon, and we'll watch from the safety of sick bay, from where, of course, we'll have a first-class view of all the casualties being carted in.
The Professor Rapson's Great Battering Ram Experiment, or the Great Professor Rapson's Battering Ram Experiment, as he persisted in referring to it, is actually a bit of a misnomer because it wasn't all Professor Rapson's show. At least 50% of it could be laid at Dr. Dowson's door, and the whole thing was the result of a long-running... Debate seems too sensible a word for some of the really quite energetic discussions they'd had over the years. Anyway, the whole thing had come to a head during a recent showing of the Lord of the Rings trilogy in the hall a couple of weeks ago. Because of the Clive Ronan threat, we're not allowed out much these days, to the endless relief of the outside world, says Dr. Bairstow, so we have to amuse ourselves. Hence Dr. Bairstow giving permission for the battering ram thing this afternoon. Anyway, every other week or so we have a big cinema experience in the hall, with popcorn and hot dogs and so on. We dragged out the chairs, put up our feet, and had our LOTR marathon. Things had been fairly sedate, for us, until the Battle of Minas Tirith and the appearance of Grond, the battering ram, and the old argument had surfaced again. There had been shouting and arm-waving, a lot of it considerably more dramatic than what was happening on screen, and with fewer orcs, too, unless you count the security section, in which case, delete the last sentence. The argument was this. Modern movies and hollows always show the castle gates opening inwards, thus rendering themselves vulnerable to battering rams and the like. Professor Rapson's long-standing and dearly held theory was that all gates opened outwards. Like lock gates, he says, so the pressure from the water or the force from the battering ram simply pushes them even more tightly closed. Dr. Dowson was vigorous in his disagreement, although whether that was from conviction or just because he always opposed everything the professor said was unknown. Anyway, as Dr. Bairstow had said, they were about to test their theories on our old barn. Now, I know it's not a castle, but it was a substantial structure and possessed two very large outward-opening wooden doors. According to Miss Lingos, who had been enthusiastically bending my ear about this for days, it would be an ideal opportunity for the professor to test his theory. I refrained from pointing out that the last time we'd tested one of the professor's theories, we'd had to take cover under the furniture, caused massive devastation to a number of rocks, and very nearly killed a leading member of the British film industry. It had been quite a lively afternoon. I had mixed feelings about this one. Not the experiment itself. I had a small wager with Peterson that the doors would hold. He was maintaining they wouldn't, but I hadn't been near the barn for some time. Not since Isabella Barclay had shot me there and I'd nearly died. They say that smell is the most evocative of the senses, and the familiar smells of wood, earth, oil and straw brought back memories I didn't want to relive, so I made sure I kept my distance. Today I was planning to make sure everyone kept their distance. When it came to this sort of thing, both Professor Rapson and Dr. Dowson had form. Under the professor's careful direction, R&D had built a sturdy wooden frame from which, on some hefty-looking chains, was suspended a carefully shaped tree trunk, finished with a pointed metal cap. Someone had painted Grond along the side in blood-red paint. I could see Lingos trotting around, checking various bits and pieces, and I thought how much Matthew would have enjoyed this,
which brought Leon to mind. I turned and stared back at St. Mary's. I was pretty sure I could see Leon and Ian sitting at an upstairs window. I waved and turned back to this afternoon's bone of contention. They'd mounted the whole thing on modern wheels, because the point of the experiment was to establish the ram's effectiveness, not its mobility. 20 or so people, 10 to a side, were heaving the contraption across the grass towards the barn. While one or two of them had remained faithful to the medieval aspect of the experiment, wearing chainmail and moderately accurate helmets, the vast majority had gone for the orc look, sporting leather and worryingly realistic warts, scars and metal prosthetics. Sauron would have enlisted them on the spot. Reaching what the professor referred to as the optimum ramming position, a phrase willfully misinterpreted by most of the security section, who had their own inaccurate ideas as to ramming and the optimum positions to be assumed for the purposes of, they ground to a halt, or groaned to a halt, if you like, and stood awaiting further instructions. Step forward that misguided missile, Mr. Bashford, bright and alert for once, who had blagged himself a leading role in the proceedings by acquiring a drum nearly as big as he was and booming out the beat. He had dressed for the occasion by removing his upper garments to grant an unimpressed St. Mary's a glimpse of his spindly physique. He looked like a very malnourished hulk. His beloved Angus perched nearby. I assumed her function was that of mascot. Leon, had he been here, would have said her function was that of most intelligent person present. She was observing the proceedings with bright-eyed interest, and her resemblance to Sykes was quite unnerving, although it would be a brave man who pointed that out to anyone of that interesting trio. For the record, no one had painted themselves blue, as the government is so fond of saying at the press conferences called in the wake of its latest catastrophes, lessons had been learned. Having achieved optimum ramming position, our stalwart volunteers threw their weight against the chains, chanting, "Grond! Grond! Grond!" I despair sometimes. Slowly at first, but with increasingly long swings, the tree trunk began to move backwards and forwards until it was scything through the air like something out of Edgar Allan Poe, building up an unstoppable momentum. "Impressive," I said to Peterson. "Disturbingly similar to the pit and the pendulum, isn't it? There will be tears before bedtime." "There always are," I said, "but today none of them will be ours. Hang on, this next swing should do it." The next swing did do it. Urged on by worryingly realistic orc war cries and drum beats, the trunk swung forwards one last time, impacting the barn doors with a massive crash. The doors fragmented into a million flying pieces, together with the surrounding door frames, and the walls, and the roof. Slowly, deafeningly, and with surprising dignity, the entire bloody barn fell down. Massive amounts of dust, chaff, and God knows what mushroomed into the air, enveloping us all.
"Well," said Peterson, coughing, "what do you know? It appears we can hit a barn door after all."
My first thought was, shit. What was I going to tell Dr. Bairstow? But as it turned out, destroying the barn was the least of our problems. And there aren't many establishments where you can say that. I fought my way out of a suffocating cloud of pulverized ex-barn just as Markham, staring over my shoulder, shouted, "Code Red! Security section to me! On the double!" And someone else shouted, "Behind you, Max!" A familiar strong wind stirred my hair. I turned around, expecting the worst. I got it. A 12-foot-high teapot was standing on the south lawn. Again. Chapter 9. I stood staring with my mouth open, but fortunately, Markham is quite well equipped to deal with this sort of thing. In only a moment, half the security section was surrounding the teapot, and the other half was racing away for weapons. Although I was pretty sure they wouldn't be needed. I knew who this was. Adrian and Mikey were back. We'd met them a little while ago when they'd turned up at St. Mary's to visit us as if we were some sort of historical curiosity, or, as Peterson had said afterwards, a major historical event in contemporary time. Anyway, they're a couple of renegade teenagers, geniuses, the pair of them, fleeing up and down time in a homemade pod and getting themselves into all sorts of trouble. Their pod, and feel free to disbelieve me, is teapot-shaped, about 12 feet high, amateurishly sprayed in what are supposed to be woodland camouflage colours, and with a hand-painted Union Jack on the side. They're constantly pursued by the Time Police, who will shoot them dead if they ever catch them. Dr. Bairstow, greatly taken with the awe and reverence with which Adrian and Mikey had regarded him, had allowed us to restock their pod, mend the radiation leak that was slowly killing them, and offered them sanctuary in the future should they ever need it. It looked as if that day had come. As if in confirmation of this thought, the hatch was thrown open, and Adrian's head appeared. He was crying.
"Help! Please help! It's Mikey! Help us!"
Dieter pushed his way through the ring of security guards. "Toss down your ladder." Their heavy wooden ladder thudded to the ground. Dieter climbed up and peered inside their pod, shouted, "Dr. Stone, we have a medical emergency here," and climbed back down again. Dr. Stone, who'd been with us long enough to know he should turn up at one of Professor Rapson's little jaunts into practical history with a fully equipped medical team, shot up the ladder and disappeared down into the pod. Dr. Bairstow appeared at my elbow.
"What time is it, Dr. Maxwell?"
"Just gone 3:30, sir."
"That pod must be out of here by 5 at the very latest."
"Understood, sir."
Adrian and Mikey were never more than 2 hours ahead of their pursuers. The Time Police couldn't catch them, but Adrian and Mikey couldn't throw them off either. It was a kind of dreadful stalemate that Dr. Bairstow had always suspected would end badly, and it would appear that today it had. Mikey was being lifted from the teapot and carefully lowered down the ladder. There was a very great deal of blood, all of it fresh. Adrian, following on their heels, was white-faced and panicking. My heart went out to him. He was so young, and Mikey was even younger. They laid her on the grass while Dr. Stone and the medical team gathered round. Someone organised a stretcher comprising broken bits of barn and an orc cloak, and a few minutes later they were all heading towards sickbay at top speed, passing Leon on the way. He hobbled towards us at the best speed he could muster.
"Is this it?"
I remembered he hadn't met our lovable scamps before. I nodded.
"Leon, we need to get this pod out of here. The Time Police are less than 2 hours behind, and they're not a nice bunch."
They weren't. Matthew Ellis is the acceptable face of the Time Police. Most of the rest of them are a bunch of homicidal thugs with the IQ of earwax. Dieter was already disappearing into the teapot. He looked over his shoulder.
"Leon, can you make it up here?"
"I can," he said,
handing me his stick. I knew better than to say,
"Are you sure?"
or "Be careful," contenting myself with, "Try not to break anything." He grinned at me, suddenly looking much younger than he had in ages. And people think he's the respectable one in our marriage. Dr. Bairstow intervened.
"Dr. Peterson, I would like you to take care of things at this end. Dr. Maxwell, see to our young friends, if you please."
We both said,
"Yes, sir,"
and I set off for sickbay. Adrian was pacing up and down, up and down, up and down, wringing his hands. I didn't know people really did that. Cox and Evans were with him. They were saving their legs by sitting down and watching him pace up and down. Not that Adrian was any threat to anyone at this precise moment.
"Where's Mikey?"
They nodded towards a door with a red light over.
"Prepping for surgery."
Adrian surged towards me, his long coat flapping around him.
"Dr. Maxwell, you have to... They shot her! They shot Mikey!"
"We'll talk about that later," I said gently. "Right now, we're a little preoccupied with saving you both from our friends in the Time Police. Mikey's getting the best treatment there is, and we're hiding your pod. All of us are prepared to lie like stink to the Time Police, so there really is nothing to worry about. Now, I need one or two things from you. Firstly, do they know Mikey's a girl?"
"I don't know. It never came up."
Evans was grinning at me. "Right, you two." I turned to our trusty security guards. "I'm taking Adrian with me. The Time Police will be here soon, and I need the security section to buy me time up here. Don't tell me how you're going to do it." I called up Markham.
"I'm going to need you to delay the Time Police for as long as possible."
"Already on it."
"Thank you, Mr. Dieter."
"Busy, Max."
How long? There's some damage here. Talk later. He closed the link. I left them to it.
Dr. Peterson?
Everything fine here, Max. A lot of barn-related trauma, but all minor injuries.
What sort of minor injuries?
The sort you get when an old barn falls on you?
Nothing serious? At all?
Not really. Even Bashwood's fine.
Good God. You sure?
I know. Sykes reckons he can't have been present when the barn collapsed and only joined us afterwards. The thing is, there's a big patch of blood on the grass where we got Mikey out.
Then we need a number of serious casualties to account for all the blood.
And you will have them. Step forward, Mr. Bashford.
I said, Tim?
And Mr. Swanson, sir, if you would be so good.
Tim, don't tell me what you're going to do.
Wasn't going to, he said cheerfully. Talk to you later. I closed the link and said to Adrian, come with me if you want to live. And Markham thinks I don't get the cultural references. The time police were 7 minutes late. Peterson tutted. Couldn't organise a piss-up in a brewery. Don't forget to tell them that, especially while they're holding their guns.
Dr. Bester was nowhere to be seen. He tends to stay back during this sort of thing. I like to think it's so he can bail us out afterwards, although sometimes I have my doubts. I was back outside at the scene of our recent barn catastrophe. When I'd left, there'd been a very large pile of dusty wood, a lot of coughing and recrimination, and one or two minor casualties. I was now present in a war zone. The surely much too large to be just our barn heap of wood was partly on fire. Smoke drifted listlessly across a scene of complete devastation. Broken people lay everywhere. Miss Lingos, Mr. Atherton and Mr. Lindstrom were half buried under the debris. Miss Lingos was artistically shrieking with pain. Half her face was smothered in blood. Atherton was ominously white and silent. Miss Sykes was weeping piteously over a felled Bashford who was pumping blood into the ground at an alarming rate.
"If they don't get a move on, we're going to run out of blood," said Peterson, casting nervous glances over his shoulder.
"Dear God," I said, appalled at the carnage.
He grinned. "Good, isn't it? Professor Rapson and Mr. Swanson got the casualty make-up out from our disaster drills. We have broken limbs, fractured skulls, severed arteries, massive internal trauma, the lot. What's one casualty amongst so many?"
A trail of injured and moaning people were being helped to their feet and slowly making their way towards sickbay. And here they came. A dramatically large black pod had materialised outside Hawking. The door opened and they poured out. Four of them, as usual. I watched them approach, guns at the ready. I whispered to Peterson,
"I gather Leon and Dieter got the pod away."
"They did."
"Don't tell me where."
"Don't know where."
"Good. Adrian? With Mrs. Enderby."
He blinked. "Okay." He turned back to the carnage around us.
"They're here, everyone. Let's go."
He began to stride out, barking orders, a shining example of a deputy director in complete control. It was quite impressive, if I do say so myself.
"Be careful with those timbers. You don't want to make things any worse. Get those people to sick bay. Report to Nurse Hunter. Dr. Stone is in surgery. Field medics to Mr. Bashford and..."
"Hey," said a time police officer. I spun around. "Oh, thank God you're here." He blinked in surprise. I didn't blame him. I went into overdrive myself.
"Give us a hand lifting these timbers, would you? Do you have any med packs on you? Miss Sykes, keep applying pressure to that wound."
I strode off, issuing a hail of instructions to those around me. What the officer should have done was pull back, let us sort ourselves out, and then hit us hard, but he seemed to be experiencing the sort of disorientation frequently suffered by those encountering St. Mary's on one of our more exciting days. He chased after me.
"Just a minute."
I turned in exasperation.
"Look, I don't know why you're here, but if you're not going to assist, then push off and let me get on with it. As you can see, I have other things on my mind at the moment. Tell Captain Ellis..."
"Ellis isn't here," he said, allowing himself to be distracted.
"Why not? We always deal with Captain Ellis. Where is he? Don't stand in that blood."
He didn't move.
"This is another matter. I have reason to believe..."
I cut across him.
"Careful how you move Mr. Bashford. He might have internal injuries."
You had to hand it to the time police. They don't give up.
I felt a slight pang. They'd rescued Leon, Guthrie and Markham from Constantinople for us when we didn't have a working pod to our name. They'd nursed Leon back to health. They were sheltering Matthew for us. Commander Hay was a decent woman. If they could just stop pursuing two rather engaging teenagers up and down the timeline, they'd almost be quite likeable. But that was their job, pursuing those engaging in illegal time travel, the penalty for which was usually death. Mikey and Adrian had been leading them a merry dance for years, for which, I suspected, they would pay heavily. But not if I had anything to do with it. Too many people had died around here recently.
It is Dr. Maxwell, isn't it?
I turned impatiently.
Yes, it is. How did you know?
Everyone knows,
he said heavily, and I wasn't sure about that.
Dr. Maxwell, I have reason to believe you're harbouring two fugitives, and...
We're not harbouring anyone,
I said indignantly. He carried on anyway.
And it's my duty to search these premises immediately.
And at that exact moment, I heard Mrs. Enderby in my ear.
Ready when you are, Max.
Of course it is, I said to him, but as you can see, we're a bit busy at the moment. You go on and make a start. I'll catch you up. I'd leave wardrobe to last if I were you. They've got a bit of a flap on at the moment.
More of a flap than this,
he said, gesturing around at the last of the survivors being scooped up for medical treatment. Well, I said, in the full knowledge she could hear every word I said, I'm afraid our Mrs. Enderby's a bit of a diva. I'd pay for that later on. My next jump was Persepolis, but I didn't mind betting she'd get me into a corset and bustle somehow. I had no idea how Mikey was faring in sickbay, but I reckoned I could leave Dr. Stone to sort that out. He wasn't Helen Foster, but he was certainly Captain Devious from Devious Town in Devious Shire. They split up, presumably so we couldn't move the fugitives around the building behind their backs, and searched everywhere. And they were very thorough. I was pleased to see they had to search manually. No one was waving tag readers around. It was obviously the pod they followed, not Adrian and Mikey themselves, and the pod was long gone. But they were good. They had a system, and they stuck to it, every painstaking inch of it. They ignored Mrs. Mack's tight-lipped hostility and Professor Rapson's careful confusion. The technical section stood outside each pod, arms folded, following their every move. No one was allowed into the pods, but all the locker doors stood open, and there was obviously nothing to be concealed. I began to hope they'd lose interest and drift away, but they knew they'd injured Mikey. They suspected the two of them had sought refuge with us, and although their pod wasn't here, there was no reason why they themselves shouldn't be. We were St. Mary's, after all. Concealing a couple of known fugitives was just the sort of thing we would do. Mikey was actually very easy to conceal because she was in theatre, covered in sterile cloths, with only a tiny area visible. When asked who the patient was, Nurse Fortunata informed them it was Miss Gray, whom they knew, who had collaborated with them in the search for Clive Ronan. She went on to say that she understood they still hadn't found him, and had they considered how much more a chance they would stand if they put some people on that job instead of faffing around getting under the feet of people who had a real job to do, and that the man standing behind them was Major Guthrie, whom they definitely did know, and she didn't think he'd take kindly to a bunch of idiots wanting to inspect his girlfriend while she was unconscious and undergoing surgery. They made a cursory check of the wards, which were bulging with casualties suffering barn-related traumas. Ian Guthrie silently and unnervingly watched them every inch of the way and personally escorted them to the door. They went over every part of the building, found nothing, and eventually we found ourselves outside wardrobe, which was buzzing like an overturned beehive. People were rushing around with mouths full of pins. I had a brief attack of health and safety. Should they do that? Suppose someone fell over. We'd be picking pins out of their tonsils for days afterwards. Others were whirring away at sewing machines. Lengths of beautiful material hung everywhere. Mrs. Enderby got up off her knees, dusting French chalk off her hands.
Is it urgent, Max? If we don't get these costumes completed today, Mr. Cutter will be invoking the penalty clause in his contract.
She apparently noticed the time policeman standing beside me.
What do you want?
I was soothing. It won't take a minute, Mrs. Enderby. They think someone's hiding here, and we don't know it. That wasn't strictly true, but a little bit of misdirection never does anyone any harm.
This really isn't a good